I'm going to study with you this morning the first few verses in the 12th chapter of the Gospel of John. You'll recognize this right away as the account of the anointing of Jesus by Mary in the house of Simon the leper. Let me say while you're turning to it that we have an account of this in Matthew chapter 26 and Mark chapter 14. While I'm not going to take time to read from those, I will be making reference to them as we study this text together. Jesus, therefore, we read in John's account, 6 days before the Passover, came to Bethany, where Lazarus was, whom Jesus had raised from the dead. So they made him a supper there, and Martha was serving, but Lazarus was one of those reclining at table with him. Mary, therefore, took a pound of very costly perfume of pure nard and anointed the feet of Jesus, and wiped his feet with her hair, and the house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume. But Judas Iscariot, one of the disciples who was intending to betray him, said, "Why was this perfume not sold for 300 denarii and given to the poor people?" Matthew records the words of Judas, "Why this waste? Why this waste?" Now John tells us he said this not because he was concerned about the poor, but because he was a thief. And as he had put the money box, as he had the money box, he used to pilfer what was put into it. Jesus therefore said, "Let her alone, in order that she may keep it for the day of my burial. For the poor you always have with you, but you do not always have me." My assignment this week, as I understand it, is to do some teaching on the basic doctrines. That will certainly bring about a revival in many congregations. That's a new thing. I'm sure it isn't here. I have gone, held revivals in churches to preach the basic doctrines of New Testament Christianity and had people celebrate. Some might have never heard that before. I wonder what they have been hearing. And if we ask the question, where do we begin? What is the basic doctrine? The basic doctrine is Jesus. For reasons I won't go into, there's a great surge today, and this surge comes from many directions, to try to separate Jesus from doctrine, but you can't do that in biblical Christianity. Jesus does not exist autonomously, that is, apart from the belief about who he is. Even the disciples who walked with him personally did not understand him, did not know him, apart from a complex of claims, theological statements, we could say, which he made about himself. That is, to believe in Jesus is not just simply to believe in Jesus of Nazareth as a person. To have a saving faith in Christ is not simply to believe that he is the Son of God. It is to believe all that he said about himself and to follow home all the implications of his deity. And so we look in this account, as we see in many others, and see the deity of Christ. That's the question, you see. We start there. Who is Jesus? The basic doctrine of the church. Peter's confession of his faith in Jesus as the Son of God, recorded in that well-known text in Matthew chapter 16, Jesus said is the foundation of the church. Now, why have I chosen this text? It's somewhat difficult to always reconstruct the chronologies because the gospel writers did not always give careful attention to chronologies. They often dealt with material in a topical way, but as near as I can guess it, and I think it's fairly clear that this Last Supper took place before the triumphal entry. I have chosen not to preach on the triumphal entry this Palm Sunday. I have chosen to take us back to the night before, because in my opinion that is more important. You see, the triumphal entry was a big demonstration, but most of the people who were there crying "Hosanna to the Son of David" were crying "Crucify him" a few days later. They didn't understand what was going on. But when we look at this event, I love this event. I love to study it and to talk about it because it is one of these events when things come together. You see, Jesus has come out of the hill country. He has been saying to his followers, his disciples, "I'm going to Jerusalem. I'm going to die." And they were hearing it very selectively, as men are wont to do. They didn't really understand what he was doing. We know that two of them were still carrying swords. We know from looking at the general sweep of the material before us that the disciples were still very confused about the nature of the kingdom. Was it going to be a Jewish world empire? If it was not going to be that, what was it going to be? They did not really like what they were hearing from Jesus. In fact, they even took upon themselves, a couple of them, to rebuke him. And the leaders of the Jewish community, the leaders of Jewish national religion in Jerusalem had sent out the word, if he comes to town again, we're going to kill him. And it was high noon. Let me summarize the situation in this way. Everybody knew that something was going to happen, but nobody was sure exactly what. You see, when Jesus showed up in Jerusalem, it was either him or them. He said so and they said so. Things were coming to a head, to a climax. Things were not going to go on as they had for the last 3.5 years, the public ministry of Jesus. And if he was going to establish that Jewish world empire, he was going to overthrow the Roman garrison there at the Tower of Antonia, if he was going to establish Jewish hegemony, he was going to do it now or never. And that's what they had in mind when they cried, Hosanna to the Son of David. He's going to take David's throne and we're going to rule. The Assyrians have had their turn and the Persians and the Babylonians and the Greeks and the Romans, and now it's the Jews' turn. That's why they had become so disgusted and discouraged with Jesus when he kept saying things like, the meek shall inherit the earth and the greatest is going to be the servant of all and turn the other cheek. And they said, we tried that and it didn't work. But now it's all coming to it, and there's drama in the air and there's tension. And Jesus has recently raised Lazarus from the dead, 4 days in the grave. Think of that. And word was going through Jerusalem about that. And so the tension is so thick you could cut it with a knife. Tomorrow it begins. But tomorrow's tomorrow, and tonight's tonight. And Jesus here has done a thing very human. You know, Jesus is the Son of God. We believe that, do we not? But he's also the Son of Man. And he's doing a very human thing, what a man would do. Before the trouble begins, he gathers together with his friends in Bethany, a few miles east of Jerusalem, over the Mount of Olives. A quiet time with those who love him. At least most of those there love him. And so we have this feast. We know it was in the house of Simon the leper. We do not know any more about him. He has one brief moment on the stage of biblical history, and then he's gone. He apparently was a man with a large house, and there was a large crowd, so they did not meet as they had before in the house of Jesus' close friends, the brothers and sisters, Lazarus and Mary and Martha. So they met in the house of a friend, may have been a relative. And they made a supper there, we read in verse 2. They made a supper there. Now, it says Martha was serving and Lazarus was there. Let me just say this. Martha, you know, some things never change. Here we're going to see Mary anointing Jesus and Martha was serving. And the word there in the original language means that she was... is the common household servant. She was helping with the meal. And you must picture that. It says Lazarus was reclining at table. Now, let me just say briefly, when they met in these feasts they had in the ancient world, they reclined at tables. They put the tables in a horseshoe shape. It was called a triclinium, which is we have two words, the prefix tri, three. It's a three-sided table. Clinium means, we get our word recline, to lay down. They would lay on couches. And if you picture a horseshoe this way, we Westerners and moderns would put the head of the table here, but the head of the table, that is where the host sat on this horseshoe, if you can picture it, was the second from the end on this side. And his honored guest would have the end of the horseshoe, the second honored guest behind him, and they would go on around this way, and the lowest seat was down here, the far end. And by the way, let me say, a few nights later at the Last Supper, you know, we pictured Da Vinci's Last Supper ever since he painted that picture. That nobody's been able to picture in their minds to visualize the Lord's Supper any other way. And that's unfortunate. He painted that picture that way for two reasons. He was not trained in ancient history, and second, he couldn't figure out any other way to get them all in the picture. At the Last Supper, we know that Jesus was sitting as the host seat. In front of him was Judas. Behind him was John, and Peter was at that end. You can ask me later how we know that, but we do know that by reconstructing the accounts. But Jesus is there, and Martha is serving. We met them before, just like this. Martha was serving. You recall when they were in an earlier event toward the beginning of the ministry of Jesus, Martha was serving in the kitchen, getting the meal ready, and Mary was sitting at the feet of Jesus, learning. And Martha sent out word, said, "Master, tell Mary to come here and help me." And Jesus at that occasion said to her, "Leave Mary alone. She's chosen the better part." Rudyard Kipling, one of my favorite authors, wrote a poem about the sons of Martha and the sons of Mary. The sons of Mary take care of ideas, of spiritual things, and the sons of Martha fix the food. They take care of the practical things, as he would call them. And he was kind of an agnostic fella. And he came out on the side of the sons of Martha. He said the sons of Martha and the sons of Mary are both necessary, but when it comes right down to it, he cast his lot with the sons of Martha. Well, there's a lot to be said for that. I spend my week, I make my living teaching the sons of Mary. But every payday, I thank God for the sons of Martha. You know, you got to have both to have a feast, just like you got to have both to have a college. Now, our college would not last very long. We sons of Mary would not be in business very long if it were not for a whole lot of sons of Martha who keep the doors open, like you. And you got to have both at a feast. You see, it's okay to sit out there and preach and talk about spiritual things, but when it's time to eat, you want there to be some food on the table, don't you? And so you need both, the sons of Martha and the sons of Mary. I would just say this before I leave this point, that Kipling was wrong. The sons of Mary had the better part. That's what Jesus said. You see, the question is, which is more important, ideas or things? And we know that ideas are more important. I'll give you an example. Why is America the greatest country that's ever existed? Because it has more natural resources, more things? Oh no. Many countries in the world have more natural resources. America is the greatest country in the world because it's built on the best ideas. And when the sons of Mary quit doing their work, the sons of Martha will have nothing to fix. Well, Martha was serving. Mary, as we have read, took a pound of very costly ointment, very costly perfume, a pure nard, and anointed the feet of Jesus. Now, we know from the price that Judas put on it, 300 denarii, that this scented oil was worth almost a year's wages. About 300 days' wages. Now, if you take out time for weekends, that's about a year's pay. That's a lot of money. Now, what they did, and we also know from Matthew's account that she anointed not only the feet of Jesus, but the head of Jesus. The custom was in those days, when you had a feast in the evening, especially when guests came from a distance, you would do three things. You would give them a garment to wear, special garment. There's special ones for weddings, but a normal garment, because people would get dirty traveling. You would put oil on the head, usually cheap olive oil, about the fourth pressing. Put it on the head, and then comb it to get the dirt out of the hair. That's a good way to clean the hair. Put oil on it, and comb it, and then the dirt would come out with the oil. It would leave the hair oily, but oily hair was not the unpardonable sin until modern times. And then wash the feet with water. Okay? The head, the cloth, the water. Mary comes in and she uses this very costly oil, scented oil, from an alabaster box, container, alabaster vial. I've seen one of those, or two of those, as a matter of fact, from the tomb of Tutankhamun. Seen them in the museum in Cairo, the Egyptian museum. They used that kind of container because it was very massive, very dense, and it was not porous. The precious contents would not seep through by osmosis. Now, when they opened the tomb of Tutankhamun, they opened those alabaster vials, you could still smell the perfume over 2,000 years. My point is, and all three gospel writers make a point of using every term possible to show that this was a very expensive thing. It may have been her inheritance. We do not know. Now, Mary did it. You know, and they criticized her, as we've read, and Jesus said, leave her alone. Leave Mary alone. She did it for my burial. Now listen to this. I think I'm right about this. I hope I'm not reading too much into the text. If I am, you can forgive me. But I think this is amazing, and I think it's significant. And it has the what the experts call verisimilitude, the ring of reality about it. You see, Jesus had been saying, as I've already pointed out, that he was going to go die. Nobody was sure exactly what. The disciples were still trying to prevent it. They were still thinking in terms of a materialistic, political, physical kingdom. It seems that only Mary got the point. What was the right thing to do? If we could get in a time machine and go back and wangle an invitation to that feast in the house of Simon the leper, we would have done, if we could afford it, what Mary did. It was just the right thing to do. She got the point. It's interesting. The men didn't. The disciples, the experts, his students, been there traveling with him for 3.5 years, they missed it. Mary got it. Women often do that. You know, I hate to say this, and maybe I'm wrong. In fact, I hope I am. But all of the things being equal, women make better Christians than men do for all kinds of reasons. The basic reason is that men are arrogant, and women usually are not. I'm not arrogant, but most other men are. And women are perceptive. My wife is a people. What it takes me 3 months to find out about a person, she knows in 3 minutes. It's spooky. If there's a man in here that thinks he really understands his wife, he doesn't. There's a woman here who would say, I understand my husband perfectly. She probably does. Women seem to sense things and pick up things. It's weird. I'm not sure it's downright righteous, but it's interesting. Isn't it something that Mary got the point? She had been tuning in to what Jesus said. And she had a clearer idea. I don't think she understood everything. But it appears to me from what Jesus said about her action that Mary had a clearer idea about what was going to happen in the next few days than anybody else. She did just the right thing. Now, there are some basic views here. This brought everything together, as I would say. Here you, when she did this, she anointed the feet of Jesus and his head as well, we know. Judas, as we put all the accounts together, Judas raised the fuss. Why this waste? Now, John tells us, as we know, Judas didn't care a thing about Jesus. He was worried about the money. He was a thief. But you see, Judas wasn't the only one who said, Judas got a bum rap here, insofar as you can give Judas a bum rap. Same bum rap that Thomas got. Thomas has come to us as the doubting apostle, because when he was told by the other apostles, the other disciples, that Jesus had risen from the dead, he said, unless I see him and touch him, I'm not going to believe a thing. But that is precisely what the other disciples, the other 10, said when the women told them. That's, you understand? They doubted precisely the way Thomas doubted. And Judas said, why this waste? And the disciples joined them. They said, he sang the first verse, and they joined him on the chorus. Why this waste? And they said, yeah, why this waste? Now, we know that Judas' position was logical. Judas had decided that Jesus was not the Messiah, and he was doing the logical thing. We might call Judas' position utter rejection. He utterly rejected Jesus. And think about it. Our account says that Lazarus was there. You see the heart of Judas when he can sit at a meal and look across the horseshoe at Lazarus. 4 days in the grave and now alive, and still not believe the claims of Jesus about himself. This underscores in my mind the biblical teaching that unbelief is a matter of the will, not of the intellect. I mean, you had to have your brain scrambled not to believe that the man who could call Lazarus from the grave would be a liar or be a fool regarding the other claims or regarding the claims he made about himself. And we see he was with one spirit with the enemies of Jesus.
Go down to verse 10. It says the priest took counsel how they might put Lazarus to death. You understand? The same crowd who paid Judas the 30 pieces of silver were working up plans to kill Lazarus. Why kill Lazarus? Because they did not want the evidence of their folly walking around. At least not that close to Jerusalem. Think about that. Utter rejection. Now what Judas did was logical. If Jesus is not the Messiah, then what he did made sense. You see, it was at least in the spirit of the Mosaic Law to put a man to death for blasphemy. The Romans had removed from the Jews the right of the death penalty, so Lazarus was doing the only thing he could do was try to organize, to arrange the death of Jesus. But you see, if Judas was right, what he did was right. You're supposed to put blasphemers to death according to the law of Moses. And Jesus claimed to be the Son of God. If he was not the Son of God, a blasphemer is exactly who he was. And so Judas did the logical thing. Utter rejection. Now, this reminds me of the nature of unbelief. A man who can look at Lazarus and talk with him in the house of Simon the leper and still betray Jesus. But that's the way it is. Get rid of the evidence. Ignore it and get rid of it. I've done business. I've been academically trained on both sides of the fence. I've been trained by men of great faith. I've been trained by atheists. Been examined by atheists. And let me tell you that atheism is irrational. To not believe that Jesus is the Son of God is to deny science and to deny history, to deny reality, to get rid of the evidence. I spend a lot of my time fighting for creationism. It's amazing that creationism is winning all the debates, all the academic debates. It was a great turn in the scientific community back to creationism. At the upper levels, every year, hundreds of Western world's greatest scientists become creationists. Why? Because of the evidence. But what are the humanists doing? They're losing the debate, so their plan is, if you can't win the debate, you legislate. You get laws passed. Kill the evidence. If you can't refute the evidence, what you do is you get a law passed so the evidence can't be heard. It's exactly what they were doing with Lazarus. Well, we have the view of the disciples who joined in. Now the disciples said, yes, why this waste? But they were not saying it for the same reason. They were just not sure. If Lazarus' position could be called utter rejection, their position could be called moderate devotion. Now we're going to see that what Mary did, we'll come to it in a minute, made perfect sense, didn't it? If she was right about Jesus. And what Judas did made perfect sense if he was right about Jesus. The only position there that didn't make any sense was what the disciples said, moderate devotion. You see, they said, yeah, why this way? Did they believe his claims about himself? Yes. Yes, Jesus is the Son of God, but we want to honor him. We want to express our devotion to him the way, and Mary has done this, but she went too far. Love him, but not too much. Give to him, but not, let's not be silly about it. After all, it's kind of silly to take what costs a year's wages and use it for what is normally the cheapest oil and plain old water. The disciples were the moderates. We could have given this to the poor, the practical men. You know, moderation always has good reasons for it. I tell you, I've been in the ministry for a long time, and God save us for those of moderate devotion. You can never get the kingdom going because those of moderate devotion say, yes, we believe, but we do not want to go too far, too fast, give too much, ask too much, work too hard. Why? Well, we want to be sensible about it. We could have given this to the poor. Isn't that practical? How do you argue with that? I can't tell you all the excellent reasons I've heard down through the years for keeping the kingdom in second gear. And when they tell you, it's hard to argue against it. Makes sense. Moderation. But you see, it doesn't make any sense. Either Judas was right, and we should utterly reject Jesus, or Mary was right, we should love him completely. It was the disciples who were being silly. Now, Mary did what was right, utter devotion. Judas, utter rejection. The disciples, at this point, moderate devotion. Mary, utter devotion. Utter devotion. Just, she went as far the other way as Judas went one way. You see, what Mary did was logical. It was just the right thing, as we've said. If Judas was right, it was a waste. Why this waste? But you see, if Judas was right, if they had taken the dirty dishwater from the kitchen and put it on the feet of Jesus, it would have been a waste. Let's have none of this nonsense about Jesus being a good man and a great teacher, but not the Son of God. If he was not exactly who he says he was not a good man nor a great teacher. Any man who came today claiming to be the very Son of God, God in human flesh, the creator of the universe, the judge of all the world, the absolute standard of truth, if he came preaching that today, he would not be viewed as a great teacher. He would be probated before noon tomorrow, and should be. He would be a lunatic or a criminal. Oh no. Can't have it both ways. But Mary got it right. You see, the dishwater would have been too much if Judas was right. But since Mary was right, was it a waste? Let me tell you, if we could in some hypothetical, mythical way reach out invisible arms and gather in all the material wealth of the universe, all the mineral wealth, all the manufactured wealth, and bring it all in some mystical way and put that wealth in that alabaster jar, it still would not have been a waste. Because he was right. Every year, Florida Christian College, we have students come, and invariably somebody has told those students, sometimes it's their parents, sometimes it's leaders in the church, God help them. Usually it's some well-meaning school teacher who'll say this, you want a Bible college? You don't want to, and sometimes they even use the word, what a waste. Why, with your talents, you could make money. You could be somebody, you could have a great profession. You're going to Bible college? Our kids get this all the time. You got why this waste? This building is here and this church is prospering because a lot of people have been wasteful. Yes. Some of you have given time you couldn't spend and money you couldn't afford and worked when you were too tired to work. And I bet you had relatives who said, what are you doing down there? Surely you're not going to be spend all that money. What a waste. What a waste. Well, it depends whether Mary was right or wrong. I married into a missionary family. My wife's family of veteran missionaries, many of them. Her aunt is Isabel Dittimore. Maybe some of you know Isabel. She spent most of her life as a widow. She married back in the 1940s Warren Dittimore. Warren Dittimore heard Dr. Shelton come back from China and the Tibetan border and challenge anybody who would go to that part of the world and to help him. He went back and was murdered by mountain bandits. The young man named Warren Dittimore heard about the murder of Dr. Shelton, and this simply redoubled his intention to go and work in that part of the world. World War II started and he could not go, and so he spent his time preparing. The military wouldn't have him because his eyes were so bad. So he spent 4 or 5 years getting a Bible education so he could teach the gospel. He spent 2 or 3 years getting a medical and agricultural education because he was going to be in the backcountry. After 7 or 8 years of preparation, the war ended and he entered immediately. In fact, his daughter, my wife's cousin, as far as we know, was the first white Western child to enter China after it opened up at the end of the Second World War. Warren Dittimore spent many months traveling. It took to get to Lee Sioux country. Worked a few weeks and months, caught typhoid fever and died before he was there a year. Prepared for 7 years, served for about 7 months. What a waste. Brilliant young man. What a waste. He's in an unmarked grave now because when the communists took over, his life was such a witness to believers that he won people, in a sense, after his death. And the communists knew that, and they would have desecrated his body, said to conceal his grave. So there he lies in an unmarked grave in the high country of Tibet. What a waste. Think so? He didn't think so. He said it. His wife and daughter didn't think so. I don't think Jesus thinks it was a waste. I think it was just right. I think it was kind of like Mary's alabaster perfume, alabaster container of perfume. Somehow, if Jesus is who Mary believed he is, somehow it's just about right, isn't it? It all depends. Well, I'm finished. The disciples learned better, didn't they? They were confused. As I've said, and I want to make this very clear, when they joined Judas and said, yeah, what a waste, they didn't understand. Later on they did. And they wasted their lives. You can read accounts of the death, of the lives and death of these men who sat around that table that night. And they were used up. They were poured out at the feet of Jesus like Mary's oil. And if you're not a Christian this morning, I invite you to come and waste your life. If I haven't made that clear, what I mean by that, I never will. You see, it all comes down to this. Either Judas was right or Mary was right. You've either got to hate him or give him everything, love him utterly. And let us not, we who are veterans in the church, fall into the error of the disciples at that time, moderate devotion. Let's not say it was a waste when we know good and well it was not. Jesus demands all or he deserves nothing. We're going to sing our invitation hymn now, just as I am, without one plea, but that thy blood was shed for me. You come and say to Jesus, by obeying the gospel, here's my life. I don't know what it's worth. Not worth Mary's oil, perhaps. Whatever it's worth, you can have it. Do what you want with it. I'm going to be a Christian. Because it's no waste if it's given to Jesus. If that's a decision you need to make, why don't you make it right now while we stand together and while we sing.